Good evening. I'm Amna Nawaz. Judy Woodruff is away. On the NewsHour tonight, targeted killing. A key scientist behind Iran's covert nuclear program is murdered, as officials there call it an act of state terror. Then, alarming numbers. Over 90,000 Americans are now hospitalized for COVID, breaking yet another coronavirus record. And desperate journey. Migrants are putting their lives at even greater risk now to cross the open Atlantic in hopes of reaching European soil. Plus, staying alive, how independent bookstores are weathering these tough economic times and their message to shoppers before Small Business Saturday.
If you love your local businesses, you really have to support them with your money. You can't just love them and think everybody else is taking care of them.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. This Black Friday unofficially ushers in the holiday shopping season. But this year, it's under the pall of the pandemic. The nation is now averaging well over 100,000 new infections daily. Today is usually one of the busiest in-person shopping days, but instead, there was reduced foot traffic nationwide. In Houston, retailers limited capacity in stores and ran temperature checks on customers. Crowds were also smaller at the Mall of America in Minneapolis, where a mask mandate was in place.
We want everybody to wear their masks. Actually, we have dedicated staff that'll be wearing red shirts as you enter the building and ensuring that you have your mask on and are wearing it properly. And then you'll also see our staff throughout the mall ensuring that you keep it on. We just want to make sure everybody has a safe holiday season.
Despite the smaller crowds in stores, analysts are forecasting an increase in holiday sales due to a boom in online shopping. President Trump has lost yet another legal round in his bid to challenge the election results. A federal appeals court today rejected his lawsuit in Pennsylvania. The court said the claims of fraud were devoid of any specifics or any proof. President-elect Biden won Pennsylvania by more than 80,000 votes. The Trump campaign said it will appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. In Ethiopia, meanwhile, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed again rejected talks with leaders of the defiant Tigray region. But his office said he would talk to representatives it says are, quote, operating legally there. Abiy met with African Union peace envoys as thousands more refugees fled Tigray's capital before the Ethiopian army launches an assault. Thousands of farmers in India marched to New Delhi today, protesting new laws that will end guaranteed prices for grain. They were stopped at first by police, who blocked their way and used tear gas. Demonstrators condemned the use of violence against peaceful protests.
India is my country, and Delhi is the capital of my country. I'm not even allowed to enter my capital city. This is in spite of farmers never doing any hooliganism. Our whole movement has been peaceful. They also showered us with water cannons, and we were also beaten.
The government says it wants to give farmers more freedom to market their produce and boost production through private investment. An all-out brawl erupted in Taiwan's parliament today over lifting a ban on imported U.S. pork. Lawmakers opposed to the policy threw pig guts when the premier tried to speak. Then fistfights broke out between ruling party and opposition legislators. Taiwan has seen mass protests against U.S. pork that contains residue of a drug promoting lean meat. Back in this country, the U.S. Justice Department formally changed its policy to allow federal executions by gas chamber, electric chair, or firing squad. Currently, lethal injections are the only authorized method. Federal executions resumed this year after 17 years without one. At least five more executions are planned in December and in January. The Trump administration is also moving in its final days to reduce protections for migratory birds. The change finalized today decreases federal prosecution of industrial operations from power lines to wind turbines to toxic waste pits that unintentionally kill birds. The new rule could take effect within 30 days. And on Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 37 points to close at 29,910. The NASDAQ rose 111 points, and the S&P 500 added 8 points. Still to come, on the NewsHour, frontline nurses battle increasing hospitalizations and shortages of protective gear, fighting to reclaim land in one of the nation's most impoverished places. And Capehart and Abernathy analyze the latest developments in the presidential transition. Plus, much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Iran's most prominent scientist, the man described by U.S. and Israeli intelligence as the architect of that country's covert nuclear weapons program, was killed in an apparent assassination today. Nick Schifrin reports on who he was and why his death is so significant.
Amna, Iranian media report that Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was driving east to the capital, Tehran, when a car bomb exploded near his car and gunmen shot and killed him. Analysts say he was the J. Robert Oppenheimer of Iran's nuclear program, its lead scientist, coordinator, and manager. Western intelligence assessed the program was shelved in 2003, but in 2018, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu unveiled a stolen archive of Iran's pre-2003 nuclear plans and said Fakhrizadeh was responsible for continuing the program secretly.
A key part of the plan was to form new organizations to continue the work. This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
Nobody has taken responsibility for his killing, but today Iranian officials blamed Israel. To discuss this, I'm joined by Norman Rule, who had a 34-year career at CIA, including a station chief in the Middle East, and was the national intelligence manager for Iran until September 2017. Norman Rule, welcome to the NewsHour. What's the significance of his killing, and what's the impact on Iran's nuclear program?
Good evening. The killing of the 59-year-old Iranian official removes from Iran its greatest institutional memory on its weaponization program. It will be very difficult for Iran to replace this, and it will actually impair their ability to reestablish a weaponization program should they decide to do so.
What's the message being sent by whoever killed him? And not only today, but the recent death of a top al-Qaeda figure reported in Tehran and mysterious explosions throughout Iran, including at one of Iran's top nuclear facilities.
These incidents, as well as the killing of IRGC Quds Force General Qasem Soleimani earlier this year, message to the Iranians that their most sensitive individuals, personnel, and issues are not beyond the reach of Western security services. Ideally, it would tell Iranian officials that they should not undertake a covert nuclear program or terrorist activities or maintain a broader relationship with al-Qaeda, because doing so would quickly come to the attention of Western institutions, intelligence organizations, and Western governments would take immediate action, which Iran cannot prevent.
Critics of these kinds of killings have an argument that they don't stop Iran's nuclear program. In fact, they can create an incentive for Iran to pursue a nuclear program, and that assassinations might create short-term successes, but can have long-term negative consequences. What do you think about those criticisms?
I think it is questionable as to whether or not his assassination will encourage Iran to undertake a nuclear weaponization program. I think in Tehran right now, anyone they might put in his place is probably wondering at what point he or she would fall under the focus of Western institutions who might undertake a similar assassination.
President-elect Biden and his team say they want to re-enter the Iran nuclear deal. What do you make of the timing of this attack just 54 days before inauguration?
A couple of points. First, an attack of this nature would have taken a lot of time to plan. So this isn't something that would have initiated in the recent few weeks. At the same time, I think it sends a message to the Iranians that regional players will take security into their own hands if they believe the U.S. is unable or unwilling to do so.
And so, therefore, does this have an impact, do you believe, on President-elect Biden's plans to return to the Iran nuclear deal?
For the Iranians, the primary impetus to return to a nuclear deal is their need for financial relief, particularly in they need to bolster their reserves to maintain their currency and the health of their banking institutions. I think for the Biden administration, looking at this deal, they're going to have to respect the security concerns of regional actors to a greater extent to avoid other incidents such as this upsetting nuclear negotiations.
You mentioned Iran's main goals. Given those goals, how likely is it that Iran responds in a major way?
There is certainly going to be a heated discussion with Iran regarding a response. There will be some who thought the response to the death of Qasem Soleimani was insufficient. And then, of course, you've had the reports of explosions, the death of a senior al-Qaeda official, and now this. Iran will need to reestablish deterrence. Iran will need to show national pride has been protected. At the same time, they won't want to undertake an action that risks a conventional war or upsets the prospect of the financial relief that would come from a return to the nuclear deal. So Iran is going to have to decide exactly what they do that walks a very fine line.
Norman Rule, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
There are now more than 90,000 people hospitalized in the country with COVID-related illness, the highest number since the pandemic began. Hospital ICUs are nearly filled in some places. The U.S. currently averages more than 1,500 deaths a day, a number that could rise once reporting resumes after this holiday weekend. All of this is putting enormous strain on healthcare workers, including nurses. Here with more on that now is Bonnie Castillo. She's the executive director of the National Nurses United Group. That's the country's largest nurses union, representing 170,000 registered nurses. Bonnie Castillo, welcome to the NewsHour. As we've seen, cases are surging across the country. When you look at the graphs, they are astounding. You see the number of new record daily high infections growing. You see, when you look at the map across the country, that no corner of the nation is untouched. The darker the shading on this map, the worse the surge is. So, Bonnie, when you look at your nurses on the front line of this, what do they not have right now that they need to do their jobs and to do them safely?
They still are lacking adequate protections. And when I say protections, I mean a comprehensive national plan of protections that include the PPE, personal protective equipment, adequate numbers of staffing, and even measures such as simple isolation testing. We are going without, and we've been 9 months into this and have had enough time to prepare. We know what we need, but we still don't have it.
I think this will surprise a lot of people that all these many months later, after all the calls for additional PPE and that protective gear, nurses still don't have it. And we put this question to the American Hospital Association, which represents about 5,000 hospitals and healthcare systems. They share your concerns. They say they have serious concerns about the availability of PPE. And they also said, in reference to the Trump administration's efforts, that they appreciate those efforts, but that the demand continues to outpace production. So, Bonnie, at this point, how do nurses get what they need? What could be done today or this week to get them the supplies that they need?
Well, we need both the hospitals to be mandated to provide nurses adequate protections, because we actually know that we're still dealing with having PPE locked away from nurses when they need it currently at the bedside. And so, but we also need a national plan. We need the, we've called for the Trump administration to fully invoke the Defense Production Act, and we need that now. Now, obviously, we are working with President-elect Biden, and we hope that we will have that in place soon. As I said, we need it now, though. Literally, what we are seeing is unprecedented amounts of hospitalizations and deaths. And we're seeing that the employers clearly are not prepared for this, and they've had more than enough time to prepare.
Bonnie, when you say that that stuff is locked away and not making its way to the nurses, what does that mean? I think people will have a hard time understanding. Are you saying it's there and just not getting to the front lines where it's needed?
So, for instance, what we have heard is reports of PPE coming in, and yet nurses are given one N95 mask for an entire shift. These masks are designed for single use only. And we still are hearing reports of hospitals expecting nurses not only to wear it for one whole shift, but oftentimes for multiple shifts. for weeks. This is going to result in infections of the healthcare workforce. And when we're infected, then we're not there to care for all these patients that are coming in.
Bonnie, what about things like regular access to testing, contact tracing, early exposure of, or notification rather, of any kind of exposure? We see professional athletes, college athletes even, getting access to those kinds of things. Do nurses have easy access to those?
No, they don't. And when you think about it, we're coming into contact, direct contact with the COVID patients. They need our expertise, and yet we are not given testing. So we've had nurses who have been caring for patients since February, March, and who still have not been tested. This is one of our central demands, is that in order for us to be safe and to give, and for our patients to be safe, we need to know if we are infected. So, you know, we, as I said, we're fighting state by state, but we really need a national plan. We need leadership that is going to take a national approach. You can't just have one state enact masking orders, staying in place, social distancing, and yet have other states completely flout that and not have an impact from that on all of us.
We are so grateful for the work that all these frontline nurses and all the frontline healthcare workers are doing every day. That is Bonnie Castillo, the Executive Director of National Nurses United. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
President Trump's visit this year to Mount Rushmore drew new attention to a decades-long battle between Native Americans and the federal government over millions of acres in South Dakota. Special correspondent Fred DeSam-Lazaro looks at the campaign to reclaim that land. His report is in partnership with the Undertold Stories Project at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota and part of his series, Agents for Change.
It is an icon of the American West, and here on the vast Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, buffalo rancher Bam Brewer says it's hard to overstate the animal's importance.
The buffalo was significant to our ancestors because it provided everything. The buffalo was like the Walmart, food, clothing, medicine, and also a sacred being, a symbol of power for our people.
Also a symbol of loss. Buffalo or bison were hunted to near extinction after European settlers arrived, and the animal's revival in small herds like Brewer's is a metaphor for the campaign to reclaim a native culture and land taken in violation of treaties the U.S. government signed with Sioux tribes in the 1800s.
I lived here all my life, and it's always been the same, poverty. I don't want that for my grandkids. I want us to come away from that. And I believe that the Black Hills is the answer.
It's not just about physical land. It's about the rebuilding of our societies and our communities.
Activist Nick Tilson says that rebuilding begins with the land, millions of acres of the Black Hills. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld the tribal claim 40 years ago, but only ordered restitution, about $1.5 billion in today's dollars. Tribal leaders rejected the money. They wanted the land, some of it in private hands, but much of it now owned by the federal government. Nick Tilson and about 150 others loudly renewed that demand when the president held a rally at Mount Rushmore last July.
This is the land of the Oshetishakoi.
Demonstrators blocked the road, drawing counter-protesters headed to the Trump rally and exacerbating long simmering tensions between tribal and South Dakota political leaders. 20 people were arrested, but only Tilson was charged, facing an array of misdemeanor and felonies, including simple assault and robbery for taking a shield from a law enforcement officer.
These are all just a bunch of lies.
Emerging from 3 days in jail, Tilson flatly denied the charges and remained defiant.
The work that I've committed my life to of building indigenous power, it's an honor to be in this moment.
Prosecutors did not respond to our request for comment on the charges against Tilson, who at 38 is regarded nationally as an emerging indigenous leader. His nonprofit, NDN, raises millions in philanthropic funds and makes grants to indigenous groups and causes, from fighting mining and pipeline interests to starting businesses on Indian lands, and taking back lands they view as their own.
Because we're not trying to burn people out of their houses or tell them, you know, remove people or perpetuate and recycle the same injustices that were done to us. That's not what we're talking about.
What he and others want is indigenous-led development to reduce the near total dependence on appropriations from Congress, managed by various federal agencies. Scott Weston is a former tribal president.
That's that government process that's holding us down that doesn't let us live like the rest of the world. We don't get to think for ourselves. It is basically dictated to us what needs to happen.
A common complaint here is that wealth has always been taken from Indian lands, and what's left behind are abysmal living conditions. Unemployment on Pine Ridge is over 80%, and life expectancy just 66, 12 years below the U.S. average.
Nonprofit advocacy groups that work on the Pine Ridge Reservation say up to a third of all households here are not hooked up for basic electricity and sewer services.
One of Tilson's efforts to address the crisis is a pilot development of energy-efficient homes called Thunder Valley, which is now run by a separate cooperative. But with just 30 homes and 48 apartments, Thunder Valley meets a tiny fraction of the vast need. It also took years to navigate federal bureaucracies for basic services.
It was super daunting, like to be a bunch of ragtag guys from the res and then sit across from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, who hand you a booklet that's this thick and say, this is what you have to learn in order to get access to water and sewer.
Another big challenge, access to financing.
The Pine Ridge Reservation, which is 3,500 square miles big, is without a single financial institution.
Tawny Brunch heads a community-based lender called Lakota Funds, which is trying to create wealth so people can afford homes. It is focused on lending to encourage more ranching by tribal members. Vast swaths of Pine Ridge today are leased to white ranchers. One native customer is former tribal president Weston. He says his sons and grandchildren now have a chance to stay and thrive in the business and on the reservation.
You see people coming from other countries into this country. You see these big opportunities that they have, whereas we're subjected to whatever the government gives us. And that's where Lakota Fund is starting to come to play.
He says it's a tiny step toward self-determination for indigenous people, a cause that Nick Tilson says is particularly timely these days.
As we're having this, you know, racial reckoning, this country will never achieve racial justice unless it makes itself right with indigenous people.
Tilson has his own reckoning. A judge has ruled there was probable cause for a trial on charges related to the July demonstration. The trial will likely be held next spring. A petition drive demanding that the charges be dropped has gathered 18,000 signatures so far. For the PBS NewsHour, this is Fred DeSamlazaro on the Pine Ridge Reservation.
The five-year migration crisis, especially in the Mediterranean and Atlantic, continues unabated, with drowning deaths now on the rise. Activists blame the European Union's policies for the deaths, and there is a plan to reform migration policy, but experts are skeptical that it will save lives. Now, a warning before our next report, you may find some images disturbing. Here's special correspondent Malcolm Brabant.
Putting faith in the Mediterranean has always been Russian roulette. This November has been a particularly wicked month. I'm not going to see my baby! I'm not going to see my baby! I'm not going to see my baby! The woman from Guinea in West Africa was crying for her six-month-old son, Joseph. They were among 100 people on board a dinghy that cast off from Libya. Most were saved by Spain's Proactiva Open Arms, the only non-profit running a civilian rescue service in the Med. ProActiva's director, Ricardo Gatti.
The rubber boat, the boat totally divide the two tubes, the floating tube divides one the other, and all the people directly fell into the sea.
I lose my baby.
Six people died, including baby Joseph.
The baby was recovered, but after some hours, the baby started to get worse and worse and worse, and he stopped breathing.
A similar capsize was captured on video by the crew of an aircraft operated by the European border agency Frontex. These people had set off from Libya towards Italy. Frontex alerted Libyan coast guards, who rescued 102 people. Two bodies were recovered. These migrants could so easily have suffered the fate of another dinghy, which earlier capsized off the Libyan coast with the loss of over 70 lives. Speaking from the Libyan port of Misrata, Steve Purbrick of Doctors Without Borders.
We're dealing with survivors of a shipwreck, a number of which who have gasoline and salt water burns, so nasty chemical burns. In addition to the mental health needs of people who have seen their loved ones drown in front of them, or who have been fighting for space on the boat that has collapsed as well, in order to save themselves.
Some of the victims of the disaster described by Purbrick washed up on beaches and were found by Libyan fishermen. Carrying dreams of a new life in Europe, they'd crossed the Sahara Desert to reach the North African coast. But Libya is one of the most dangerous places on earth.
We hear numerous cases of abuses, of torture for ransom, as well as other forms of violence that's directed towards the migrants who have little to no legal protection inside Libya.
23-year-old Mulyom Suleiman was lucky. He was picked up by Doctors Without Borders earlier this year. He's from Cameroon in West Africa, where an insurgency has forced 500,000 people to flee their homes.
We have decided to leave our home because we don't really feel satisfied with home because of war, be it economic, social or political problems. At least, I think Europe should send us a hand. You really need your hand.
Stay where you are.
Europe's five-year-long migration crisis has been punctuated with tragedies that only witnesses remember. This was July 2016 off the Libyan coast. 22 perished after their dinghy sprang a leak. In their haste to get off, the migrants were stepping on the corpses of people who'd been alive an hour earlier. 9 months earlier, an overcrowded boat went down off the Greek island of Lesbos. More than 70 people are believed to have drowned.
7, 8, 9, 10. 12, 13, 14, 15. So hot.
Come on, God.
There's no problem.
There was an enormous outpouring of public sympathy 5 years ago. But one of the real problems was that the sympathy didn't translate into empathy.
Sonia Skeets runs Freedom from Torture, a London-based non-profit.
We are still seeing refugees as others, you know, people not like us, to feel pity for at these particular moments when our emotions are heightened.
As far as non-profits are concerned, the situation in the Mediterranean has deteriorated. This video leaves no doubt about their stance.
EU governments are doing everything they can to deny their responsibility to those seeking safety, turning a blind eye to those in distress, leaving people adrift for hours or even days without food, water or medical attention.
It's a policy of stopping people at any cost.
Hasiba Haj Sarawi is the humanitarian affairs advisor of Doctors Without Borders, or MSF. We first met 4 years ago during a three-week-long assignment aboard the Aquarius, the non-profit's rescue ship. The Italian government forced the Aquarius out of the Mediterranean. It was replaced by another vessel, Sea-Watch 4. But that too has now been impounded by the Italians.
MSF, since it has been at sea trying to save people who are trying to cross the sea, has been subjected to a campaign of harassment and criminalization of its activities. A campaign of criminalization that is very reminiscent of authoritarian governments and certainly not of European countries ostensibly committed to the rule of law.
Doctors Without Borders and ProActiva accuse the Frontex border force of helping Libyan coast guards to return migrants to inhuman conditions and possible torture. Frontex denies participating in illegal pushbacks. it says it adheres to international law by alerting the nearest national rescue centre when it spots a vessel in distress. And in many cases, that means Libya. The European Commission, the executive arm of the EU, has recently outlined plans for a new migration policy. It proposes fast-track screening of potential asylum seekers before they cross external borders. It's an attempt to discourage people from setting sail in dangerous craft. But Hanna Behrens, director of the Brussels-based Migration Policy Institute, has little confidence that it'll stop people from coming.
There's so little room to move through these kind of legal channels, such as resettlement. There are very limited opportunities to come to Europe through legal migration. So these people who are often very desperate, whether it's because they're fleeing persecution or because they're having very little chances to sustain themselves at home, they will continue to move to Europe. And in the absence of very legal and safe channels, they will have to rely on smugglers and other more criminal networks.
In a sign of increasing desperation, thousands of Africans trying to reach Europe by avoiding Libya are taking to the Atlantic Ocean with its storms and currents. They're launching from Senegal in West Africa and aiming for Spain's Canary Islands, 1,000 miles away. 17,000 people have made the harrowing journey this year, a tenfold increase from 2019. The Spanish authorities have been building emergency camps to cope with the recent influx. Senegalese activists say that clandestine immigration is nothing new, but this year has been catastrophic, with nearly 500 deaths recorded. This week, 8 more people were added to that ghastly toll. Found on the shores of the Canaries, their remains were carried on stretchers, wrapped in emergency blankets. There's little doubt the waves will continue to be mass graves, as long as life is so bad at home that people are prepared to take these kinds of risks to escape. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Malcolm Brabant.
Let's turn now to the analysis of Capehart and Abernathy. That's Washington Post columnist Jonathan Capehart and Gary Abernathy, an Ohio-based writer and contributing columnist to the Washington Post. Both Mark Shields and David Brooks are away this week. Jonathan and Gary, it's good to see you. Thanks for being here. Hope you both had a safe and happy Thanksgiving. Let's talk about the transition, shall we? It has been weeks since the election. The race has been called. I don't know about where you live, but here in Virginia, most of the yard signs are down. And yet the president is still casting doubts on the election, to the point where yesterday, when a reporter asked him and felt he had to ask him, would you leave the White House? Take a listen to what the president said yesterday.
If the Electoral College does elect President-elect Joe Biden, are you not going to leave this building?
Just so you, certainly I will. Certainly I will. And you know that.
Just this afternoon, then, the president tweeted this. Biden can only enter the White House as president if he can prove that his ridiculous 80 million votes were not fraudulently or illegally obtained. Gary, I'm going to start with you here. Why is the president continuing to call the entire election a fraud? Who is he talking to here?
I suppose, and thank you for having me tonight, and Jonathan, good to see you. I suppose he thinks that this plays to a part of his base that, you know, like him, just won't accept the idea of defeat no matter what. But I'm very disappointed in him doing this. Let's make it clear. On January 20th, Joe Biden's going to be president, and that happens whether Joe Biden gets to enter the White House or not. I'm sure he will, but being into the White House doesn't make you president. The people of the United States do that, and that's what they did. But I hope that in short order, I was willing to give President Trump a couple of weeks to, you know, do his legal challenges, answer any questions that might really be out there about fraud. I think we've done that. I think we've looked into it. I know there's still some stuff going on out there, but nothing that's going to pan out, really. And so it's time for President Trump to set an example for America, even for his base and for the rest of the world, and say, you know what, let's get on with it. And he did that in part by, you know, agreeing to let the GSA go ahead with the transition and telling his agencies to cooperate. But he needs to take that last step and say, okay, I acknowledge it's done.
Jonathan, what about you? What do you make of the messaging coming from both the president and also from President-elect Biden, who hasn't really engaged on a lot of that fraud conversation?
Well, what we're seeing between the two of them is a stark contrast. On the one hand, you have an incumbent outgoing president who, since Election Day and certainly since the election was officially called for President-elect Biden, has basically given up on doing the actual job of being president, still lashing out on Twitter, lashing out yesterday at the White House, no matter what he says. As my friend Gary says, he will no longer be president come noon on January 20th. So we just put that off to the side. But by contrast, you have President-elect Biden, who's ignoring the charade coming out of the White House, ignoring the taunts, ignoring the traps that the president thinks he's laying for Joe Biden. But President-elect Biden, just through his Thanksgiving Day address to the nation, reminded the country of what it's like to actually have a president of the United States who puts the care and comfort and concerns of the citizens ahead of his own needs, wants, or objectives. And by moving forward and starting to name his cabinet, doing the actual work of showing what a Biden government would look like, I think just the contrast could not be more clear, and also explain why 80 million Americans went with Joe Biden and not with the sitting incumbent president.
Well, Jonathan, to your point, let's take a look at some of those cabinet picks and the top administration posts that have already been rolled out by the Biden-Harris team. Take a look at some of these folks who have been named so far, and we've heard a few others reported. Jonathan, when you look at those roles and some of the other top posts that we've seen names released for, a good number of them are Obama alumni. What do you make of this criticism that some people say this just looks like a third Obama term?
Well, look, I think those folks who are criticizing President-elect Biden for this are being a little short-sighted. The last Democratic president of the United States was President Obama. The people who we just saw there, I mean, let's take, for instance, Secretary of State designate Antony Blinken. He was Deputy Secretary of State in the Obama administration. And so this is a promotion. There's a wealth of expertise and knowledge and stature among the people that you just showed, which is only a small part of the cabinet that President-elect Biden is going to announce. And so I would say to those critics, you know, settle down, be glad that there are people who are coming into the government willing to come into the mess that they're about to inherit, to turn those agencies around and also to turn the United States around.
Gary, when you look at what President Trump has been doing over this last week, he's been doing what a lot of outgoing presidents do, which is exercising his presidential power and considering some pardons. There was this pardon for General Mike Flynn, right, who had pled guilty to lying to federal agents about his Russian contacts. What did you make of that decision to pardon General Flynn?
Well, I mean, I felt like that was the least surprising event of the week. I think a lot of people have been anticipating that President Trump was going to make that pardon, issue that pardon. You know, there are strong feelings about this case. I'm on the side where I thought, you know, how James Comey originally, to this day, described how he took advantage of the White House kind of being in disarray early on. So he didn't really follow protocols, and he decided to send an agent into the White House to see what they could find out. And then they have this conversation with Flynn, who at first denies having any contact with the Russians, which is kind of strange because based on what we know, what he said to the Russians, there was nothing wrong with that. But then for some reason, I guess he panicked, he denied saying it, and there's no doubt about that. But when you look at the history of presidential pardons and presidents going back, you know, four, five, six presidents often pardon or offer clemency, issue clemency to allies and people that were close to them. That's what the president has done, and however you're going to feel about it, it was not surprising that he did it.
There is a bigger issue here. I'd like to get you both on. If we can be brief, we'll be able to get to both of you. But the continued undermining by the president of the entire election process, even as Gary, as you say, he's just talking to his base who may never accept it, it does continue. We're moving into two key runoff elections in Georgia. The president said he's going to be campaigning on the ground. Jonathan, are you concerned that the longer the president undermines that process, the harder it will be for Biden to govern?
Certainly, but there's a time limit on this. A little more than 50 days, and then we won't have to worry about President Trump undermining the electoral process. But also, I think it still is incumbent upon Republicans of conscience and stature out in the country, but particularly on Capitol Hill, to rise up and speak out against things that are anti-constitutional, anti-small d democratic, and undermine the rule of law.
Gary, what about you?
Yeah. I really hate to agree with Jonathan very often tonight, Amna, but I have to agree with him on this. The president, for the sake of everyone, for the sake of the belief in our process. You know, again, I was not opposed to taking a couple of weeks and saying, let's look at some of these allegations, let's investigate them. But I think we've done that. And now for everyone's sake, you know, for the good of America going forward, for a signal to the world that, you know what, we have honest elections here in this country. We have a peaceful transfer of power in this country. I'd like to see the president do that. And I hope he goes so far as to, when January 20th comes around, Amna, I hope that Donald Trump will stand there to the side of Joe Biden as President-elect Biden takes the oath of office.
Dare I ask you, in just a few seconds we have left, both of you, on this Thanksgiving week, if you'd like to share one quick thought on what you are thankful for. Gary, you want to start?
Oh, thank you, Amna. Well, naturally, like most people, I'm really grateful for my family, for friends, and I'm still grateful to live in what I think is the greatest country on earth, with the greatest opportunities on earth. And despite what we're going through right now, you know, some people say, oh, there's a constitutional crisis and so on. Really, our system works. It'll continue to work. And this process has shown us that, and on January 20th, we'll put a stamp on the results of this election.
Jonathan, what about you?
To be perfectly blunt, I'm thankful for the election of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris for what it represents. The 80 million people who put them into office opted for a return to normalcy, decency, and putting in a government that respects the American people, the Constitution, and the rule of law.
And we are thankful to both of you for joining us this week. That's Jonathan Capehart and Gary Abernathy. Good to see you both. More than 264,000 Americans have died during this pandemic. As we do every Friday, we look now at some of the lives cut short by COVID-19. Brian Fonseca's personality was as loud and colorful as his shirts. In high school, he found a home at the theater, first as an actor and later as a director and theater owner in Indianapolis. He was fearless, known for putting on shows that explored controversial or taboo themes and for prioritizing diversity in his ranks. He was a tough and demanding leader, but a lovable friend, brother, and uncle. At age 65, he maintained an insatiable curiosity, especially about his Mexican heritage. He collected Day of the Dead art and enjoyed ending the day with a glass of good tequila. Alexandra Chitwood was kind and agreeable, her husband said, but a fierce advocate for students who needed her guidance as a school counselor in Manheim County, Pennsylvania. Their marriage was a fairy tale love story. They met on a school trip in Rome, Italy. They would go on to explore the rest of Europe together, to try new recipes and restaurants with friends, raise two sons, and become grandparents. According to her husband, it was the happiest 10 years of their lives. Alexandra was 47 years old. George Longoria Jr. was a quintessential Houstonian, his family said. For 30 years, the security guard worked every type of event in the city, from comedy shows to concerts to sporting events. An active sports fan himself, George played soccer as a goalie, starting at the age of 5. The 50-year-old was described by his family as adventurous, playful, and funny, a supportive husband, and encouraging father. Thank you. Peyton Baumgarth had an electric personality, his family said. He was charismatic, loving, and effortlessly hilarious. From a young age, Peyton had a love for music and video games. The St. Louis area native wanted to be a video game developer when he grew up. Peyton's mom described her son as mama's little boy. They enjoyed spending time together, shopping, crafting, or just holding hands and watching TV. She said he and his older sister loved each other fiercely, too. Peyton was only 13 years old. Spoiling his children and grandchildren brought Edwin Montanano so much joy, his kids said. Edwin came from humble beginnings in the Philippines and immigrated to the United States at age 26 to pursue a career in nursing. He worked at New Jersey's St. Michael's Medical Center for 36 years with his wife, who was also a nurse. Described by their children as a perfect match, Edwin and his wife loved to travel together. Jovial, funny, loyal, and generous, Edwin was 73 years old. Ahead of Small Business Saturday, Jeffrey Brown takes a look now at the plight of independent bookstores struggling to stay afloat in a challenging economy. It's part of our ongoing arts and culture series, Canvas.
Another day in the life of an independent bookstore in the time of pandemic. Packing orders, customers at the curb, and on this day, a few allowed inside, and constant phone calls.
Okay, just give me your name and number.
Sometimes their first question is, are you open? And we say, well, sort of, kind of, maybe, what can we do for you?
In fact, Source Booksellers in Detroit's Midtown is open, just not in the way it used to be. It's a tiny store, 900 square feet, owned and operated by 83-year-old Janet Webster Jones and her daughter, Allison Jones Taylor. Janet had worked in the Detroit Public Schools as teacher and administrator for 40 years. Beginning in 1989, she built on her love of books, first selling them at local bazaars, fairs, and churches, later as part of a women's business collective, finally opening the store here in 2013. It's a highly curated selection, mostly nonfiction. History, health, books by and about women, art. Things they love and want to share with customers.
You're your own algorithm in a way.
You got that right.
We try, hope that our books, even if it's a storybook or a fiction book, it gives a history and a story that you may not get otherwise.
I think that's gonna be it.
This was a place all about personal interaction until March, when the store was closed and business disrupted. Out of necessity, mother and daughter changed it up.
We did not have a website where you could buy things before. And so this is absolutely new. Mm-hmm. And we had to learn all of the shipping and receiving, all these
packaging,
different things that we were not doing before.
By going online, they found a wider audience with sales as far as Maine, Washington State, and abroad. They also went old school, taking to the phones to reach individual customers. As a Black-owned business, they saw the heightened interest in social justice issues translate into new relationships with businesses seeking large orders of books for their employees. And it continues to evolve.
Many times people come in and talk about having a business. They tell me that I dream this, and I say, I did not dream this. Opportunity and courage put this business together over a period of time.
But opportunity and courage at any time is required. What about with the pandemic?
Well, with the pandemic, the opportunity came for us to shut down and change. And we had the courage to just shift. And the possibility, because we had grown in our capacity to do things in the store.
These are perilous times for independent bookstores. According to a recent study by the American Booksellers Association, more than one indie has closed each week since the pandemic began. And 20% across the country are in danger of closing. Renowned stores like Strand in New York and Vroman's in Los Angeles have said their survival is at stake. Everywhere, once popular author appearances and book club gatherings are virtual. And many stores continue to do curbside-only business.
A lot depends on your community and how much they appreciate you.
At 43-year-old Watermark Books in Wichita, the cafe is closed, but the store itself is open to customers.
It's about Dolly Parton's feminism.
Owner Sarah Bagby had to lay off employees and shorten store hours. But a move to online sales has helped make up for other losses. Bagby, who bought the store in 1996, has been in this business long enough to survive past crises, and sees this one as again forcing stores like hers to focus on their core business.
It's funny, when the box stores opened, typically independent stores became better business people or they closed. Now with this pandemic, we are better business people again. We've limited our time open. We have taken away the fat that wasn't generating revenue, and we are just selling books.
And they're part of a new effort to take on the elephant in any room full of books, Amazon. The fact is, book sales have risen during the pandemic. People are home reading more, teaching their children. But it's Amazon that's benefited most. A campaign called Boxed Out was launched by the ABA at several stores around the country, including Watermark.
Our messaging is just think about where you're shopping. If you love your local businesses, you really have to support them with your money. You can't just love them and think everybody else is taking care of them.
Source Booksellers in Detroit is also part of the campaign, and mother and daughter are hyper-conscious of the local role they play in a community that has continued to support them, whether through small development grants or through checks from loyal individuals.
Human beings need relationships on every level of their lives. And so that's why we were very dedicated to having a bookstore that would foster relationships. Mm-hmm. I have people coming in the store oftentimes, I think, anybody else, saying, I know I can get this from, I won't say the word, but I wanted to buy it from you. And we're very grateful for that.
But is it sustainable? In this industry, some books can make a big difference. Independent bookstores are counting on Barack Obama's memoir to kick off a holiday season that could make or break many. As COVID cases again explode, stores that are open face new closures. And every small business owner shivers as the cold weather sets in.
We don't know how sustainable anything is. We don't even know. I'll say this as an old person, we don't even know if our life is sustainable. So we have to live on the faith and the hope and the purpose of serving the community as best we can, of responding to the needs that come to us because of outside forces, being clear with our own DNA, what we have decided is our offering to the community, and going forward. That's the best we can do.
Read a good book lately? Bought a good book lately? If you're lucky, you might find one just down the street. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
On the NewsHour online, William Brangham talks to a Michigan grandmother and her granddaughter about their political differences and their advice to families navigating similar divisions this holiday season. That is in the latest episode of our podcast, America Interrupted. You can find it on our website, pbs.org/newshour, or wherever you get your podcasts. And now a brief update before we go tonight. The city of Los Angeles has issued a stay-at-home order prohibiting all public and private gatherings with anyone outside household members. The order goes into effect Monday and lasts until at least December 20th. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz. We'll be back right here on Monday. Until then, please have a great weekend. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.